Green Sense Radio is brought to you by Green Sense Farms. We're changing the world with sustainable indoor vertical farming, growing more with less. Our leafy greens are sold live so they burst with flavor. Visit greensensefarms.com and watch us grow.
Welcome to Green Sense, a weekly look at the people, policies, and innovations that are changing our world. Here's Robert Colangelo.
Thanks for joining us. I'm your host for today's show.
And I'm Bob Kessler, executive producer. Back when we started doing Green Sense, how many hybrid or green cars were there on the market? Like two? I think it was the Prius and maybe one other. Well, that has really grown, and Tom Appel from Consumer Guide Automotive will actually have a look back on this year, 2017, in green cars. And if you want to know something about the climate, there's an amazing online app where you can pretty much find out anything and everything.
But we're going to learn how many plug-in hybrids there are. And this app's pretty amazing. And it's all coming up on this week's edition of Green Sense. Up now, Tom Appel, Consumer Guide Automotive Publisher, with an extended green automotive news. We're taking a look back at the year 2017 in green cars. Welcome, Tom.
Hey, thank you.
Well, I've got a little tidbit here. When we first started featuring you on Green Sense, the options for green cars were pretty much the Toyota Prius and little else. Can you believe we started doing that 7 years ago?
No, actually, no. I would have never guessed 7 years.
Well, it's been a pleasure, and you are the guru of gears, the sultan of speed, and you're everything we've made you out to be. You've not let us down. We really appreciate you being on the show. So let's take a trip down memory lane and see what we learned this year about green cars. What about in the last year? How have green cars offering grown?
Yeah, it was a fascinating and wonderful year for green technology in the auto world. Because one of the things that was really sort of marginal technology just 2-3 years ago that just caught on like wildfire this past year, was the proliferation of plug-in hybrid cars. There are now, by my count, 17 of those now available to the public, when there were just a couple of them a while before. We might remember that there was the Toyota Prius plug-in was one of the first. Now that's just one of dozens. It's wonderful.
That's amazing, Tom. 17 plug-in cars. And what do you give the proliferation of these cars to? What's the cause?
Well, what's happening is that everyone's trying to gear up for the eventual 2025 54.5 MPG mandate. And to do that, people are going to have to electrify their offerings. So we're seeing people do all sorts of things to make their regular cars more efficient, but they can offset a lot of that if they have people driving these plug-in vehicles.
Are there other ways to hit those CAFE standards, getting higher mile per gallon out of the car fuel efficiency than going electric?
Yeah, there's a couple of things that people could do. The first, obviously, is the pure electric vehicle, and that's the best way for a manufacturer to try to offset their average corporate fuel economy numbers. Then there's the plug-in hybrids. That's vehicles that you can drive in gas mode, but also you can plug in for some period of time that it'll operate as an electric vehicle. Then there are simply conventional hybrid vehicles and just more efficient vehicles as well. At the moment, I'm driving, for example, the Hyundai Elantra Eco, which is a gasoline-powered vehicle just tuned for better fuel economy. So those are sort of the stages of increased green economy.
Well, where I was going with that, Tom, is every time I go to Europe, I get, 40 to 50 miles per gallon in some of those smaller cars. Has the U.S. given up on that as a way to achieve higher MPG?
Yeah, they sort of have. Americans will not buy very small cars. The Ford Fiesta is probably going away. Hyundai has just redesigned the Accent, but they've really simplified the lineup because they don't actually expect to sell very many of those. Chevrolet is talking about killing either the Sonic or the Spark, their subcompact offerings. So in each case, there just really isn't a buyer base for small cars. Americans like slightly larger cars. They like better equipped cars. So the answer has to be technology. We're not going to do it through some sort of frugality when it comes to the size of the vehicle.
Do you see plug-in electric cars or plug-in hybrids leveling off, or do you see that increasing?
I think we're probably going to see that increase. One of the things that you get is a hybrid vehicle that you also have the battery operation. So for a lot of people like me, I could probably during the week almost squeeze by in some of these plug-in hybrid vehicles using it as an electric vehicle. On the weekend when I tend to drive to Milwaukee from Chicago, then I have a vehicle I can drive there and get better mileage because it still operates as a hybrid.
What percentage of total auto sales are made up from green cars?
It's hard to say. Like EVs still make up, pure electric vehicles make up less than 1%. I think hybrids make up 3 or 4% now. Anything that we might call green is probably still under 5%, but the number is growing. And what's nice too is the mainstreaming of these vehicles. We're increasingly seeing things that suggest that buyers are less interested in whether or not they're hybrid and just accepting the vehicle or shopping by fuel economy. I don't think there's any stigma or a lot of value to the word hybrid anymore, as it's going to be phased out.
Well, I was amazed at Bob Lutz's position, who's the former CEO of GM, who I think under his watch, they killed the original electric car, how he is such an advocate for electric cars these days.
Yeah, Bob was a really charismatic character when he was at General Motors and remains so. And he was one of the biggest advocates for the Volt. And I distinctly remember him going on a PR tour trying to promote the Volt and also trying to get to explain the Volt to people who did not understand how a plug-in hybrid might work.
Yes. So it sounds like that's moving forward. Well, let's take a look at some key areas that were highlights last year. Hybrids.
Sure.
Give us a quick summary of the new developments that happened this year.
Well, the big thing in hybrid, we have a brand new Toyota Prius, which is sort of the epitome of the hybrid vehicle. It's one of the few standalone hybrid vehicles that was redesigned. And the Prius Prime came online, which is their new advanced technology extended range plug-in hybrid, which now has more range. That's almost 30 miles, I think, for plug-in. It works very well. So that was an advancement in the hybrid world. Again, we've talked about the plug-ins. We have BMW with 3, Mercedes with, I think, 3. We have a minivan plug-in hybrid now, and that's the Chevy Chrysler Pacifica.
What about high mile per gallon gas cars? We talked a little bit. Has the high MPG gotten higher?
Fuel economy, the corporate average for fuel economy seems to be roughly stagnant right now because gas has been relatively affordable. Some people are moving to crossovers, and that's offsetting those gains. But the good news is that crossovers are becoming more efficient as well. So at some point, we're going to see that improve again. Right now, we just have this transition period where people are getting out of cars.
And let's talk a little bit about pure electric vehicles. We've talked about the Bolt and the Tesla numerous times, but now Tesla is talking about this semi-truck that they've started showing plans for. Where do you see the pure electric vehicle going?
Yeah, the semi-truck is a really interesting one. And the one that Tesla is promoting, as people may have heard or read in the news recently, there are people interested in these vehicles. So they're placing orders for a vehicle that doesn't even exist yet. And you can make the case. A battery-operated over-the-road truck probably doesn't work because it'll need to stop too soon and too frequently to make that work economically. But around town, an electric vehicle, which produces prodigious torque from an electric motor, is really well-suited for heavy freight. So for short ranges or mid-ranges, an electric truck makes an awful lot of sense, just as long as it's within the range of the batteries.
Well, this is a little bit of a black eye on the industry. A few weeks ago, a Volkswagen executive got 7 years in prison for his role in the Dieselgate scandal. Will VW be able to bounce back from that? And how much did that impact the industry?
Oh, that's a huge impact on the industry. And I think a lot of people are scared right now. The more we read about this and the more we learn about this particular scandal, it looks like that most people were aware that it was possible to game the system by modifying the time and the duration of the time that a motor was operating within compliance of the laws that are set up for diesel emissions. Volkswagen just most scandalously and most blatantly. And now Volkswagen sells no diesels in the United States and may never do so again. To some extent, this may have accelerated the rate which diesels disappear from passenger cars anyway. Diesels are very efficient. They're great things to drive because they just use very little fuel, especially on the highway and at idle. But they're not very clean, and they're difficult to keep clean. And as we moved forward and tried to become cleaner, it looked like diesels weren't really going to work for us anyway. So this has really just hastened that. We're going to see diesels in pickup trucks. and in big over-the-road trucks. But passenger cars, it's probably pretty close to dead.
How deep does this scandal go? Are there other executives for other manufacturers that may have embellished or cheated on their claims?
Maybe. We've seen other manufacturers under the microscope. Chrysler FCA has been looked at for the diesel that was in the Ram pickups, but they've also been cleared. There were some compliance issues, but I think they got those fixed. Other manufacturers are being looked at, but it doesn't look like anyone cheated as blatantly or as calculatedly as did Volkswagen. So I think everyone's just a little bit scared, and we don't see that many diesels right now. And I don't know how much we're going to see them. I think that there's a lot of redirection of effort now towards electrification.
We talked a couple weeks ago about how green cars are normalizing and becoming commonplace. The reason we have talked about cars for the last 7 years is that just like the iPhone transformed communication and Apple disrupted the cell phone, we felt that the car industry was at that point where we were going to see disruptive change. I feel like green cars have somewhat plateaued. Are there any new game-changing technologies on the horizon, or are we now at a point where we're just going to see incremental change for a while in transportation?
I think the acceptance now and what we're going to watch happen over the next 3 to 5 years is the movement of from the electric vehicle from marginal vehicle to second, from marginal second vehicle or kids run around on the weekend vehicle to primary vehicle. That's the change we're looking for right now. So we're looking for pure electric vehicles with ranges over 200 miles, replacing people's main vehicle. And that's the change that I think is going to be the hardest. And we have some vehicles coming that I think will help make that change. Every manufacturer is working on a pure electric vehicle that they're going to try to sell in that space. And it's up to Americans to accept that. And I think that one of the most interesting things that we can credit Tesla for is the normalization of the electric vehicle. I think there's been no bigger game changer in terms of how people accept things in the automotive world than the Tesla Model S's success in becoming primary vehicles for people who make good decisions about car buying.
An area we may have some departure on is the assimilation of the autonomous car. What's your predictions? When are we going to start to see more and more autonomous cars?
Yeah, we are definitely in a hurry up and wait position. Just today, for example, I spent some time with Tesla driving the Model X, and I played with the autopilot system. And the autopilot system is sort of an advanced level 2 system where you have to keep your hand on the wheel. Tesla claims that they're already, that vehicle is fully ready for level 3 autonomy, which means that you can take your hands off and needn't be paying attention, but they're not prepared to do that legally, and then local laws and other considerations don't allow for that yet. So I think the technology is running way ahead of society and certainly legislation.
Tom, thank you so much for sharing your thoughts and for working with us for the past 7 years and helping to educate myself and our listeners on the changes in the transportation market. You have a wonderful holiday, and we'll talk to you in a couple of weeks.
Well, Robert, it's always a pleasure, and thanks for having me.
That's Tom Appel, publisher of Consumer Guide Automotive. As always, read his reviews at consumerguide.com and subscribe to the Green Sense Radio podcast when you visit greensensefarms.com.
This is Bob Kessler, executive producer of Green Sense Radio. Every week, we cover environmental issues and meet passionate people and sustainable innovators. You might have noticed we do it with very few commercials. Our advertisers, they're just part of what supports GreenSense. We need the help of our listeners, also passionate people who care about the planet and know the value of independent media, which matters now more than ever. We've just launched our fundraising drive so you can help us continue to bring you informative and inspiring shows. Your contributions will cover our small production staff, which seeks out and schedules interviews, edits them, and puts together GreenSense every week. Plus, there's the cost of online hosting and studio equipment. So when you visit greensensefarms.com, click on Radio Show to make a contribution via Podbean. Takes just a few minutes, and as we often say on the program, individual actions multiplied by millions can yield big results. So if you're inspired by our positive and informative shows, we're asking you to help keep GreenSense going. Visit greensensefarms.com and click Radio Show to contribute to our fundraising drive via Podbean. On behalf of all of us at GreenSense Radio, thank you. Green Sense Radio is brought to you by Green Sense Farms. We're changing the world with our sustainable indoor vertical farming, growing more with less. Our leafy greens are sold live, so they burst with flavor. Visit greensensefarms.com and watch us grow.
As much of the national conversation over climate change seems to be mainly over whether or not it's real, anyone and everyone who can get online can use climateengine.org to research all kinds of climate data, current and historic. Here to tell us more is Dr. John Abatzoglu with the University of Idaho and co-principal investigator of Climate Engine. John, welcome to Green Sense.
Thanks for having me, Robert.
Climate Engine launched last year. How has the first year of operations been going?
Pretty good. This is a work in process. So we're continually trying to bring in new data sets and visualize them. And it's a bit of a moving platform to work with. We've received a lot of really positive feedbacks. One of our goals is to basically take this huge amount of data and make it accessible for everybody with a computer.
Climate Engine is funded in part by Google, and that's part of why it's a free web app. But I'm sure it was quite a journey going from an idea to a working app. Can you give us a quick summary of what that was like and maybe highlight a concrete example of what was the most challenging?
That's a good point. Yeah. So, you know, we have this great idea. And as scientists, we have the capability, supercomputers, to deal with gobs of data. But one of the things that we were trying to get at is that a number of agencies, both in the United States as well as globally, may not have access to dealing with, you know, may not have access to big computers and big, you know, software packages. So we wanted to try to harness basically the power of Google Cloud Computing. And so that sounds like a great idea and it's super abstract, but you know, what was nice, at least through this grant with Google, is we got to actually work with some of the engineers at Google that helped us figure out some of the hurdles, because it is one thing to envision an idea and it's another thing to actually take it to completion. So we worked pretty closely with engineers at Google, and there's been a number of other people who have been basically trying to harness the power of the Google Cloud to provide sort of these big geospatial data sets to the general public.
Google's a marquee name, and that brings with it pros and cons. What was it like to work with Google on this?
So Google's pretty busy, right? So they have a lot of other things to do. We're not necessarily high on their priority list, but nonetheless, we've worked with them pretty well. We've been able to bring in new data sets, and they've actually every year they have a Google Summit. So I haven't personally gone, but we have a number of people working on this grant, including the Desert Research Institute. And we've sent people working on this grant to Google headquarters to, you know, attend things like office hours with Google employees. So they've been nice in that they've basically provided this platform for us to do science and to make our science accessible to wide audiences.
How do you see the field of climate research growing and changing because of this free online web app that provides so much data in so many ways?
Good question. So I think that there are ways in which by telling this, so it's one thing, I guess it's one thing for people to take a look at a graph. And we've all seen graphs of the global temperature over the past, you know, past century. And for some people who are very in tuned with graphs, it makes a lot of sense. But for other people, it's often, you know, actually telling a story with pictures, viewing the planet and seeing how the planet has changed through time, that might paint a more compelling picture. So we see this as actually a tool that can be used by scientists, and it has been used by scientists, but we also see it as a communication tool because we can actually, you know, look across the planet and look at some of the declines we've seen in snow cover, you know, over the past 30 years or so. So I think it's a nice tool to, you know, go beyond just a graph and actually look at the entire planet in a pretty quick fashion.
What are the kinds of information someone can access on Climate Engine where they can't maybe access that in other applications?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so there's we have a lot of different data sets that people can pull from. They can access them in other formats. In some cases, it might require you to, again, have access to that supercomputer. But some of the data sets that we have are your sort of run-of-the-mill climate variables, temperature, precipitation, wind speeds. We also have a large collection of satellite imagery, and these can provide pretty impressive information about how green your vegetation is, you know, the amount of snow cover you might have in a location. And some of these get down to fairly high spatial resolution. So we can actually look down at individual fields, like a, you know, like 100 by 100 foot, you know, sort of that's the sort of resolution that we can get down to at individual field levels and look at basically how green that field is and maybe even say something about how much water is being used on that particular field. So there's a lot of interesting things that we can get from the combination of climate data and then also the imagery from satellites.
My guest is John Abatsaglu with the University of Idaho, and we're talking about the new Climate Engine app, which provides online data. John, I think this is fascinating that you're able to provide imagery with facts and figures. I'm also still a little baffled that there's climate deniers. You're working with data all the time in hopefully an objective, fact-based setting. What do you say to climate deniers?
So I guess the things that often come up, and there's sort of like a top 10 list of what a lot of people who are dismissive of the concept of human-caused climate change will say. But one thing that they talk about is that the planet's not warming. The temperatures have not warmed. And if they have warmed, it's due to manipulation, scientists deliberately manipulating temperature data. And so one thing that we can often point to is let's just assume that the thermometers are wrong. What else do we have on our planet that is suggesting that we're seeing large-scale changes? And, you know, the other indicators are around us. Sea level rise, you know, decline in sea ice extent of mountain glaciers, snow cover, spring coming earlier, green up happening earlier in the year. And I think visualizing that globally, as well as in your own backyard, can become a pretty powerful concept. I think it's easy to look at one individual location that where you, maybe we haven't seen as much warming or change. But when you look at the globe as a whole, it's pretty hard not to take all the individual pieces of evidence that all point to a warming planet and still argue. So I think that's one thing, at least with these products that we're providing here, is we can look at the entire globe over the past 30 or 40 years where we have pretty good data. You can play around with it and see.
One of the ideas that just came to mind when you talked about matching visual data is seeds and plants. As climate changes, we get different areas where plants will grow, and you get different ecosystems, and you get different pests that occur. Are you able to show graphically a move on how plants that were once grown further south are starting to move further north? To me, that would be very graphical.
Not with the particular data sets that we have built into the current Climate Engine. There is a pretty interesting data set in the United States where they're actually mapping crop types every year. And it's only for the past 10 years or so, but they've been doing that yearly. And I've looked at some of that data, and you can certainly see changes in crop types. I haven't necessarily seen large-scale changes, but there would be a possibility of looking for things like that. I do agree with the concept that climate change will shift the geography of where crops can be cultivated, and that might provide opportunities for some areas and often require, you know, changing up the mix of cultivars or crops that you plant. If you're in a region that might end up seeing the current crops, current agricultural practices be detrimentally impacted.
Or even pests like termites, you know, they may have been much further south and now they're moving north. So, you know, there's additional precautions that need to be taken so that people start to, you know, see the impacts, and they also have the ability to change things. That's, I think, part of the frustration of climate change is it feels too big, and it's something that you have very little ability to impact or change.
Right, to adapt to, yeah, right.
Well, tell us something positive. Has anyone approached you, or have you heard about someone who is able to generate something that from the Climate Engine app that really surprised or impressed you?
There's one example. So across the Northern Great Basin, which is a terribly dry area, it's mainly, you know, semi-arid landscape with sagebrush. There have been some efforts to try to restore watersheds or restore sort of, flowing water in areas. There have been a number of efforts to do that, and people have often asked how effective are these. And monitoring programs don't typically allow for, you'd monitor an area for multiple years. But with Climate Engine, we can actually go in to points where people have tried to, restore a stream to provide more riparian habitat. And we provided the website to colleagues, and they've actually found that this is an effective tool to basically monitor these very, very remote areas from space, from your desktop, without having to go out each year and actually collect data. So this might actually be helpful at providing information in some of these more remote areas over the long term to test out how effective some of these treatments are for restoring landscapes.
Well, I think this is fascinating because just as Google Earth, shocked the world when it first came out, and you think about how that's aided, business, science, and industry, I think once you're able to overlay climate change, it will also have just a magnificent impact. John, thank you so much for joining us on GreenSense. We wish you the best of luck and keep up the good work.
Thank you, Robert.
That's Dr. John Abatsoglu with the University of Idaho Climate Engine. I'm Robert Colangelo, and this is GreenSense. Subscribe to our podcast when you visit greensensefarms.com. Thanks for listening to this week's show. Can you believe, Bob, that we're going on our 10th year of GreenSense?
I believe it.
It's amazing how much ground we've covered, but more important, how we've built a base of loyal listeners. This is the holiday season. There's a lot of noise out there in the news these days, and there's a lot of things to distract your attention, but we appreciate you focusing on GreenSense and being one of our listeners. So Bob and I wish you and your families a happy holiday, and we wish you a green new year.
GreenSense Radio is brought to you by GreenSense Farms. We're changing the world with sustainable indoor vertical farming, growing more with less. Our leafy greens are sold live so they burst with flavor. Visit greensensefarms.com and watch us grow.
GreenSense is recorded in the Duneland ecosystem on the eastern shores of Lake Michigan. The program is copyright GreenSense Farms, all rights reserved.